supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And then we hear about the perpetrator. Have they been found, and how is their trial proceeding? But what happens to the families of the victim? Their grief and suffering was so public for a short time, but it quickly becomes invisible. On today's show, we'll hear excerpts from a recent discussion with three mothers whose sons were murdered. All three have turned their experience into activism. They are working to help others affected by murder and to end violence. This event was part of our In the Spirit of Family series, presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Dan Gottlieb's guests were Dorothy Johnson-Spite, Sherry Mandel, and Kathleen O'Hara. Dorothy Johnson-Spite is a therapist who founded Mothers in Charge, a community advocacy and support organization for mothers who have lost children to violence. Sherry Mandel is director of the Kobe Mandel Foundation and the author of The Blessing of a Broken Heart. Kathleen O'Hara is a psychotherapist, anti-violence activist, and author of A Grief Like No Other, Surviving the Violent Death of Someone You Love.
Dorothy, let me start with you. 6 years ago, your 24-year-old son had just won a scholarship to graduate school when he was murdered. Tell me what happened.
I got a call from my stepson telling me that my son, Khalik Jabbar Johnson, 24, had been shot in front of their home. My husband and I went to the hospital and after a few hours realized that there was nothing they could do to save my son. He had been shot 7 times. He was shot by a person that lived on the block, and he was shot to death over a parking space. An argument that he had had with a person on the block a day or so earlier.
What happened to you that night?
That was the worst night of my life. My life was changed forever. And even though it's been 6 years, it still sometimes feels like it was yesterday. I remember the doctors walking to me, telling me that they had did all that they could do, and there was nothing else they could do to save my son. It was horrible. I guess before I got the phone call, I was a mother, a wife. Khalik was my firstborn, so the plan was for him and I that he had recently graduated from University of Maryland. He had an undergraduate degree in sociology. He kind of followed in my footsteps. I'm also a therapist by trade. And he said that he wanted to go into the field. So we had decided that he would get his master's degree and I would get my PhD and we would work with children at risk. So before his murder, we had plans. We had plans that we would work together to make a difference in the city, working with young children. That night, my life was changed forever. I still have flashbacks and the tape still plays in my head, especially this time of year, of that night and that phone call. It's a pain that if you have not experienced it, I cannot even begin to describe. It's the worst pain in the world. And it's a pain that you wake up with in the morning and you go to bed with that night. And while it's not as bad as it was 6 years ago, every day it's a challenge to figure out how to live with the pain and how to go on knowing that you're never going to see the person who means so much to you. Today, I am an advocate for families who have experienced what I've experienced. I work day and night to make a difference with the issue of violence in our city and surrounding areas, with the most courageous group of women I've ever had the pleasure of meeting, which is the Mothers in Charge. Mothers in Charge started with 3 mothers, and today in this city, we're over 300 members and supporters. And these women give of themselves every day to make a difference in spite of their own grief. So that is my life today. That is who I am today.
Sherry Mandel, that same year that Dorothy lost her son, you lost yours. Tell us what happened.
Kobe was 13. He was in 8th grade. We had moved to Israel when he was in 4th grade. So we'd been in Israel for 5 years. And, of course, he didn't tell me, but he and a friend, Yosef Ishran, decided to cut school and go hiking. And it was the beginning of the Intifada. And they went down to a canyon near our home. And they never came home. They were met by terrorists who beat them to death with rocks.
You use the image of that cave a great deal. Tell us about what that cave means to you.
Well, the cave is total darkness. Where I live, there's a cave that stretches for 2 miles, and we really hope that Kobi and Yosef were lost in that cave. And friends went out at midnight to search the cave, and I was so sure that they would find them there. And you, if you're in that cave, you can't get out of that cave by yourself unless you have a light, because you can't even see your hand in front of you. And grief is like that. The grief and the pain that Dorothy was talking about. People, thank God most people don't know that pain, because it really feels like it's going to, like razor blade, just cutting you into pieces, and that you can't survive that pain. And the pain is also a kind of madness, that you feel that it's a wild animal that's just going to destroy you. And so the cave is a place where you're all alone, and there's nobody there to help you, and there's no way out. And I didn't know what to do with it.
A wise person once said, the only way to fix pain is by not trying to fix pain. And that when you try to fix pain, it makes it worse.
Right. People want, they want people in grief to feel better. And that is destructive, because, you know, why should I feel better? My son was just murdered. How could I feel better? And the
fact... Did you even want to feel better?
No, in fact, in a way, feeling better feels a little bit like a betrayal, because I have to say I do feel better, that most days I don't wake up in pain. It's always there with me. It's like a little bird inside of me that's always fluttering and saying, you know what? Don't be too happy, because you're in pain. But feeling better also feels that I'm losing Kobi, because I'm losing my connection to him. And there is a feeling that with time, he's not here, and he almost evaporates. And that's the pain now. It's not the pain of the grief. It's the pain of he's not here.
Your imagery switched when you talked about the wild animal inside of you to a little bird.
Well, I work a lot with imagery. I wrote a book called The Blessing of a Broken Heart, and the part one is the cave, and part two is the bird's nest, because the cave, it's an image of darkness, but if you flip it over, it becomes almost womb-like, like a nest. And all of this darkness is also a place from which you can take flight.
Kathleen, your telephone call was a bit different. You received your call on Memorial Day 99, learning that Aaron and his roommate were missing. You were left for a while, wondering, terrified, not knowing. How many days was
five.
That?
Five days. We went to Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio, and the teams assembled to go and search for Aaron and Brian, and we kept hoping that we would find them alive, and people would say, well, you know, it's been 3 days, they're probably dead, which to me was like a terrible thing. And of course the media, you know, sensationalized everything, but I think that I knew that they were gone. And you talk about the birds. When I got to the hotel in Steubenville, I was getting hysterical. It was getting too real, and I went in and I took a shower, and I came out of the shower and I went to the outside of the pool area, and I saw these two birds, and they were sweeping and chattering, and they were happy. And I thought that that was a message from Aaron and Brian, that they were okay. And I looked up and I saw the evening star, and I knew that they were okay wherever they were. My human heart wanted to believe they were still alive, but I think already I was preparing, because I knew. But I also knew that they were all right wherever they were. And there was that one moment that stopped the hysteria, and that I went and did what I had to do.
Did you feel crazy?
Yes, absolutely. But there's something that happens, I think, in the shock of violence that you go on automatic.
We're listening to excerpts from a recent conversation with three mothers who lost their sons to violence. This event was part of our In the Spirit of Family series, presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Dan Gottlieb's guests were Dorothy Johnson-Spite, Sherry Mandel, and Kathleen O'Hara. Dorothy Johnson-Spite is a Philadelphia therapist who founded Mothers in Charge, a community advocacy and support organization for mothers who've lost children to violence. In addition to supporting families affected by violence, Mothers in Charge reaches out to communities, schools, and perpetrators to end violence. Sherry Mandel is director of the Kobe Mandel Foundation and the author of The Blessing of a Broken Heart. The programs and camps of the Kobe Mandel Foundation aim to help bereaved children and adults, creating a network of support for families in grief. Kathleen O'Hara is a psychotherapist, anti-violence activist, and author of A Grief Like No Other, Surviving the Violent Death of Someone You Love. Kathleen works for Victims' Rights and Services and is a member of the National Organization of Victims' Assistance. We'll be back after a short break. This is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
And you're listening to a special Voices in the Family right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Well, coming up at 1, it's Day to Day right here on 91 FM, and they'll be talking about the presidential candidates and the hope to stake big claims in California's upcoming primary. Find out what it will take for them to win. And here's your Franklin Institute forecast for today. Mostly sunny skies, but cold. A high of 29, very windy, too. Right now in Philadelphia, we have sunny skies and 22 degrees.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. We recently hosted a panel discussion with three mothers who lost their sons to violence. They talked about their lives, how they deal with their grief, and their anti-violence activism. This event was part of our In the Spirit of Family series, presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Dan Gottlieb's guests were Dorothy Johnson-Spite, Sherry Mandel, and Kathleen O'Hara. Dorothy Johnson-Spite is a Philadelphia therapist. Her 24-year-old son, Khalik, was killed in 2001 over a parking space. She founded Mothers in Charge, an anti-violence and advocacy group for families. Sherry Mandel is a writer who lives in Israel. Her 13-year-old son, Kobe, was killed by terrorists in May of 2001. Sherry is director of the Kobe Mandel Foundation and the author of The Blessing of a Broken Heart. Kathleen O'Hara is a therapist and author. Her son Aaron was abducted from his college dorm room and murdered in 1999. She's a victims' rights activist and the author of A Grief Like No Other.
We all know the stages of grief, you know, shock and denial and so on and so forth. Do you think that process changes or is fundamentally different when a child is a victim of violent death?
There's a lot of things that are different. There's no time to say goodbye. And the thought that somebody has done this, you know, the three of us, we know someone has done this. This did not have to happen.
Well, which brings up another emotion, and I want to talk to you, Dorothy, about that. I wonder about rage.
That is definitely something that I experience, anger and rage. And I can actually compare, you talked about the murder versus a death. Murder is something totally different, and Kathleen's book really alludes to that. It's a grief like no other. I lost my 3-year-old daughter in 1986. So I'm experiencing grief on both ends, on both types of grief. The grief of a natural death. She died of bacterial meningitis at 3, and also the murder of my 24-year-old son. Murder is something so totally different because you do have to deal with the media, the justice system, judicial systems, the fact, as you said, someone actually deliberately took the life That's something far different from someone dying of a natural cause. The fact that someone has taken a life, made a conscious decision to take your loved one's life, brings about all kinds of issues, anger and rage like no other. Angry at the person who's responsible, different systems that you attribute to your son or your daughter's death when it's been a murder.
Was it violent rage? Did you want revenge? Did you want to hurt this person or kill him?
I think initially I did. I went back and forth between wanting to kill that person and wanting to just die. So, yeah.
Either way, it was a murderous rage.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Sherry, how about you?
That wasn't my response. My response was such a horrible pain that I don't think I ever got to the anger.
You think about the people who did this?
I try not to think about the people who did it. I mean, I want justice. Kobe's killers haven't been found. And I definitely want justice, but I feel like it's really important to me and to my family and to my other children to lead a positive life. And if I get too absorbed with anger, then I think it would be destructive. I think what we've done in terms of transforming our pain into a kind of giving and a kind of love and helping other terror victims to transform their pain has given me, I don't think of it as vengeance, but my mother always said to me, the best vengeance is a good life. And I really believe that.
Dorothy?
Oftentimes, it's what you do with the anger, as Sherry said. I think that's the most important thing that we can get from all of this. I think people have to understand, though, if they are angry, it's a normal reaction to what has happened, but it's what you do with that feeling, what you do with that emotion, so that it's not exhibited in some destructive way. I think Mothers in Charge has been a way to take my anger and turn it into something positive, but surely I felt it.
When I talk about anger in my book, or for example, when I talk about forgiveness, because there's a lot of conversation about forgiveness, my theory is feel the anger first. And like Dorothy said, transform the anger. You know, we're going to have anger, but I think if we allow it to disfigure us, it'll destroy us. If we allow it to transform us, we'll feel it first, though. And in the book, I talk about healthy and unhealthy ways of displaying anger. You know, an unhealthy way is to develop a drug problem or an alcohol problem or a violent problem.
One of the byproducts of this that I see over and over is people say, my life no longer has meaning right now. Why should I worry about my body?
You know, I talk a lot about the way that we suffer, because there, in this grief that is so powerful, it's, you know, I think we have to decide how we're going to suffer and what we're going to find meaning in. And I think personally in this country, we run from any kind of suffering. We're not very good at it. So when something like this happens, you find out, can you suffer? Do you know how to do it? Is it going to destroy you or is it going to transform you? I made a promise early on, you know, when it looked like I wasn't going to make it, to say, okay, Aaron and Brian were shot in the head on the hill that morning. Am I going to die too? Is that bullet going to kill me too? I have to make a choice. This is the worst suffering I've ever had. Is it going to destroy me? Or I'm going to find something inside that helps me.
Sherry, how about you?
We run a foundation. We run a camp for 600 kids, and we've worked with 500 mothers who've lost children to terrorism. And we see now that we're training our mothers to be grief counselors. And there are mothers who are able to take their experience and to rise from it, because it also is a teacher. And it also teaches you about life and about how precious life is. And it can also elevate you in a painful kind of way. It's not that there's not the suffering, but it also brings a kind of beauty with it. And that's a very hard thing to say, because I don't want this kind of beauty. You know, I'd rather be reading trashy novels in bed. But that's not what I was given.
Tell me about the beauty.
For example, Kobe was killed in the canyon. And for a year, I didn't want to go see where he was killed. And then there was a hike for the one-year anniversary of Kobe's murder. And we went to the cave, and I didn't think I wanted to go in. But all the people who had walked ahead of me had lit candles in the cave. And so when I walked into the cave, the whole thing was filled with light. And it was extraordinarily beautiful. And I see it with my children now. When I take care of my children, I mean, not always, because I am normal now, but that first year, I felt like making my child a sandwich was like going to heaven, because I was so happy that he was alive. And it just put me in contact with really this glory of life. And we just all take life for granted, but, you know, just go outside and look at a leaf. And all of a sudden, that leaf is full of God.
Dorothy, in my research, I read a lot about dreams, repetitive nightmares that keep happening. But it was a dream that you had that started Mothers in Charge?
Yes, and I'm not sure it was a dream or a vision that was given to me. But I remember it as if it was yesterday. It was actually in April of 2003, near the end of the month. And a young man by the name of Kite Staten, who lived in my community, had been murdered. His story was similar to my son's story. He was 18 years old. He was getting ready to graduate from high school. He had been accepted to Howard University. And he was shot to death in front of a pizza place in North Philadelphia, not far from where I grew up. And I saw this over the news that night. And while lying in bed in a fetal position, really feeling the pain of my own child's death, and then hearing this news and hearing the story and feeling the pain for that mother as well, it was like a vision. I saw the mothers with bullhorns in a boxing ring on what we used to call Columbia Avenue, but it's now Cecil B., right where this young man was murdered. So in my vision, in my dream, there were just many, many mothers with bullhorns in this boxing ring in the middle of Cecil B. Moore Avenue, and we had these bullhorns, and we were begging the young men to put down their guns and to call a truce. And that was how it came to me, that the mothers had to do something. The mothers who had lost children to violence had to be a force that would make a difference in our city. And that's how Mothers in Charge was started.
Tell us about Mothers in Charge today.
Today, there's chapters of Mothers in Charge in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Recently, we started a chapter in Brooklyn, New York, Delaware County, Chester, Delaware County, and Norristown, Montgomery County. And we're doing everything from working with organizations around safer gun laws. There are too many guns in our community, too many guns, illegal guns that end up in the hands of young people. We work in many schools throughout the city, teaching young people conflict resolution, anger management. We work with parents. We do many different things. We're even working with now, in the last year, young perpetrators of violence, young men who have committed murder, all under the age of 18 years old, and been court adjudicated as adults. They're mothers in charge, members of Mothers in Charge, that go into a Philadelphia prison to work with these young men, trying to figure out why, what would make a 16-year-old pick up a gun and take the life of a mother. We've got to talk with them. And a lot of them are going to come back to our community. We've got to find ways that they don't continue to stay on that path and provide resources and supports for them so that we don't continue to have mothers come to our organization because they've lost their children.
Sherry, tell us about the Kobe Mandel Foundation. How was that born?
We saw that our children were really suffering. My other kids, Kobe was the oldest and he was 13. My other kids were 10, 11, and 6. And a lot of people came to talk to us and help us, but my children went back to school a week after Kobe was killed. And the teachers didn't understand. Their friends didn't understand. They didn't understand what they were living with. And even I would go to speak to the teachers. And the teachers, they were helpful, but nobody could grasp how difficult it was for my children, that they couldn't sit in school and do math or study science. And so I became a kind of advocate for them. And we realized that there needed to be a place for kids to heal, because kids don't want to go to a psychologist for grief. You know, they don't want to feel that they're not normal. And so we wanted to do something to keep Kobe's spirit alive. And we started a foundation, and Kobe was murdered in May of 2001. And the summer of 2002, we had a camp with 150 children. And we knew right away we wanted there to be therapy at the camp, but it had to be indirect. So when the kids have art, it's art therapy. When they have movement, it's movement therapy. And when they have drama, it's drama therapy. But there's also counselors who volunteer, and there's one counselor for every three kids. And the counselors are in touch with the kids all year. Like my son, Gavi, his counselor calls him all the time. I hear them talking on the phone and laughing, and he looks forward to seeing him every 3 or 4 months.
You talked about keeping Kobe's spirit alive. I want to know about your spirituality. Your Judaism was, and obviously still is, very important to you.
Well, I grew up very secular. I knew nothing about Judaism. I knew I was Jewish, but I couldn't have told you what Hanukkah was about. I had no idea. And then I went to Israel, and I began to study Judaism. And I loved it. I thought it was such a beautiful religion. And I loved the structure. I became an observant Jew, which meant keeping the Sabbath and keeping the dietary laws and learning. But I had no feeling for God. It was like I liked the sort of lifestyle, but I didn't pray, and I didn't have any faith. And after Kobe was killed, all of a sudden I felt that I needed prayer. Like the words of the prayer book were words that were large enough for me, that had a kind of richness, because regular language was so cheap. You know, when I heard people talking like, you know, did you go to the dentist, or how much did those boots cost, or did you take the garbage out? It was like I couldn't stand regular words. And somehow going to the prayer book and going to the Psalms, I started reading Psalms, and I felt this is my story, because this is a story of great pain and great suffering and great hope.
Kathleen, you talk about your faith a lot. It comes into your writing, into your speeches. This has to shatter your faith, at first anyway.
No, actually, it worked kind of in the reverse for me. I think that when I grew up, I had a strong faith, raised as a Catholic. And then in the 60s, I thought other things were God. And I had a pretty good time. And then somewhere along the line, I discovered God again, a power greater than myself. And I think when I had my children, when you first give birth, you see that. And I started back on my own journey. But it meant that I had to tear out everything I thought I knew or assumed about God. And through those years, and I also started meditating in 1982, and I started making a daily practice of that. So in the God that I developed was a loving God, was a kind God. But people do what they do. Human beings killed Aaron. God did not kill Aaron. So when Aaron died, the one thing that I did have was a very strong faith, not dogmatically, not that, but a tremendous belief in the eternal. That's what I believed in.
I want to ask you, Kathleen, from a therapist perspective, and maybe Dorothy, you can weigh in on this also. Can one survive this without faith?
Faith is not a dogmatic set of principles. There's a belief. You might think nature is God. If you believe in something that is greater than yourself, that is universal, that is perpetual, then maybe you defeat death. Obviously, on the physical, my son is gone. I go to the grave, I know he's there. But I personally believe that the spirit persists. Now, if a person doesn't believe that, maybe they believe in the goodness of the world, what remains. Maybe they believe in the life of other people there that they love. I don't necessarily believe you have to have a faith, but certainly I think that believing in life, in goodness, helps.
I think for each individual it's different, and I think a lot of it has to do with the relationship you have with the person that you've lost. For me, my relationship with my son was so very, very special. And I think that's a part of the healing, that you're able to make that connection and have that relationship continue. Now, if it's through your work or through some type of vision or work that you have to improve, you know, the world you live in, then that's fine. But I think that is what my organization does for me. It's actually an extension of my son. And I think we have to find ways to continue relationship even when you've lost someone. Find a way to make that connection.
We're listening to excerpts from a recent conversation with three mothers who lost their sons to violence. This event was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Dan Gottlieb's guests were Dorothy Johnson Spite, Sherry Mandel, and Kathleen O'Hara. Dorothy Johnson Spite is a Philadelphia therapist and the founder of Mothers in Charge. Sherry Mandel is director of the Kobe Mandel Foundation and the author of The Blessing of a Broken Heart. Kathleen O'Hara is a therapist, anti-violence activist, and the author of A Grief Like No Other, Surviving the Violent Death of Someone You Love. We'll be back after a short break. This is Voices in the Family right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Indeed, you're listening to a Voices in the Family special this Martin Luther King Day Monday on WHYY 91 FM.
Supporting WHYY, Abington Friends School, a co-ed Quaker school serving students from preschool through 12th grade. AFS is committed to developing the talents of each child with a balance of academic rigor and joy in learning. AFS is known for its arts program, athletics, and atmosphere of collaboration, helping graduates to be well-prepared and well-rounded. Open house this Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. To register, 215-886-4350 or abingtonfriends.net.
It is 12:38. This is 91 FM, and we bring you Talk of the Nation today at 2 o'clock. Martin Luther King Jr. and the White House will be the topic, relationships of collaboration and provocation. And here's your Franklin Institute forecast for today, sunny with a high of 29. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 21 degrees. Right now in Philadelphia, it's 23.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. We recently hosted a panel discussion with three mothers who lost their sons to violence. Dan Gottlieb's guests were Dorothy Johnson Spite, Sherry Mandel, and Kathleen O'Hara. Dorothy Johnson Spite is a Philadelphia therapist and the founder of Mothers in Charge. Sherry Mandel is director of the Kobe Mandel Foundation and the author of The Blessing of a Broken Heart. Kathleen O'Hara is a therapist, anti-violence activist, and the author of A Grief Like No Other, Surviving the Violent Death of Someone You Love. We were taking questions from the audience.
Yes, my name is Robert Sargent. I'm a survivor myself. My mother was murdered by my father. I'm a member of Delaware County Parents of Murdered Children. What would you recommend, how would you recommend reacting to people who, in the public or even in your own family, who really don't understand, tell you all kinds of stupid things. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. The forgiveness issue, get over it. How do you recommend somebody dealing with that, the people who don't really understand?
Kathleen?
I think that if people don't realize how insensitive they're being, I think oftentimes you're well within your rights to say, back off. That's not where I want to be, or don't talk to me about that, or do you realize what you're saying? And often, though, in early grief, a lot of times we don't have the energy to even do that, and our lives become very small because we're afraid that people are going to ask us these things. And sometimes in our family it's very difficult because people don't know what to do.
Psychoanalyst Sheldon Kopp said that love is the ability to manage your helplessness in the face of a loved one's suffering. And that's what happens when people say dumb things to you, to us. It's about their helplessness that they can't manage. You can look and see their anxiety and discomfort. They want to do something. They need to do something. They can't. So they say things that wind up being harmful. Do we have another question, comment?
Good evening. My name is Kano Robinson, and I am sorry for each of your losses. My wife recently lost her sister in childbirth, which is a little different. My wife directs a lot of her grief and anger towards me, because I think I'm the natural person for her to do that. Did you feel that you needed an outlet for your grief and your anger? Was it directed at something or someone? And then secondly, if you do have a spouse, I'm curious if that person's grief was the same as yours or different, and were you able to help each other, or did it become a source of contention?
Dorothy?
Yeah. They say that the death of a child between a husband and wife is the most difficult, and that even the divorce rate after the death of a child is very high among couples when a child dies. And to answer the part about the anger, yes, I felt myself, maybe even years after, apologizing to folks who were the target of my anger. I talked about my anger and my rage, and sometimes it was misdirected. It, you know, whoever happened to be nearby got it. And I had found myself going back oftentimes and apologizing for that. Again, anger is a normal emotion. It's what you do with it. And so I think counseling is a real way to help work through the anger. Counseling or grief therapy and things like that.
People are going to grieve differently. There may be commonalities, but everyone is going to grieve in their own way. And I think between husbands and wives it's very difficult because men are going to grieve differently than women. Men traditionally will hold it in. They'll go out and work more. They won't talk about it. But they'll also have more health problems. They may end up by repressing it. It comes back in a stronger way. There's alienation between the spouses because of that. It's an incredibly difficult burden to bear, and it destroys many families and many relationships. So if there's ever a time to get help, that's got to be it.
A family cannot contain traumatic grief. Mm-hmm. It's just too big usually mm-hmm. for a family, and you really need a community. And that's where neighbors and friends or a therapist are really necessary. And when people are isolated, it becomes unbearable to carry the pain, and you lash out because you don't know what else to do.
You use that word. That word came up around your camp, isolation, to help kids deal with the isolation. Many people, after trauma, and myself included with my trauma, find that the sense of isolation and aloneness and solitude, one of the most difficult, painful emotions of all. Kathleen?
I want to say something about that in terms of the isolation. I think that in culture here, the idea of murder is so stigmatized that families are very isolated. And Dorothy and I have talked about this a lot. Well, okay, it's happening in that community, so it doesn't have anything to do with us. Okay, those people are isolated over there. And that's the worst thing that can happen. Because then it's like good victims, bad victims. They're over here. It doesn't have anything to do with us. So we isolate ourselves. And people feel the stigma of murder. Well, what was your son doing? Why did he? Oh, people don't just get murdered. Well, they do get murdered. That's what happens. So we're in somewhat of a denial, and I think that feeds the isolation, particularly around violence. And I think we need to look for ways we can support each other culturally.
When you said people do get murdered, my reaction to that as I was listening, I forgot my job here on the panel, and I heard those words out of the ears of a child, and I said, well, that's just too scary to know. I don't want to know that.
You don't want to know it, and people don't want to know it. They think as long as it's happening in North Philly or wherever it's happening, then we're okay. We could, you know, and that builds the isolation in America we have. Well, you know, if I could buy a big enough house and a big enough fence, I can keep everybody out, and I'm going to be safe. Because the truth is we allow murder in this country. We allow it.
Question in the audience.
In 2003, I lost my daughter, Dina. And I have a problem when someone comes around me and they start talking about their children or their daughter and what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. I have a problem. I get this bad feeling, and I just don't know how to handle it.
What do you do when somebody says something and it just opens up the wound inside?
And it does, especially when you hear others talking about a whole family. Their whole family's intact. You know, there are constant reminders of our loss, and it does magnify the missing of your loved one. And while the person is probably not intentionally making you, wanting to make you feel bad, you sort of take it personal, because here's someone that you're wishing that you could be, in a sense that you wish that your family was intact, you wish that things were the way they used to be. And so you feel a certain kind of way about that. And it's really the pain of the loss. It's the pain of missing your loved one. And I think, again, the way you work through that is to get that help, to be able to talk through those kinds of emotions and those kinds of feelings. We've got to really realize the importance of therapy and counseling when we're dealing with a loss of a significant person in our lives. Don't think that you have to do this all by yourself, that you have to be strong and go through this alone. There's nothing wrong with reaching out, getting counseling and support that you need. Even sometimes you may find it's just for a short period of time. We'll help you get through.
Can I suggest something? That the great agony here is feeling alone, because you look around in your world and nobody, or almost nobody, has lost a child. Almost nobody has endured the pain you've endured. So the great agony is feeling alone in the world. And maybe the healing is knowing that's not going to go away. Maybe the healing is when that sense of aloneness hurts less.
And I think that's the importance of support groups, because you find that you're not alone. You know, you'll find the support of someone that has experienced what you've experienced. So you don't feel such a sense of loneliness or being alone. And someone else maybe can tell your story.
You know, what you're feeling today is not what you're going to be feeling tomorrow. Remember that. But feel it. Now, there's a numbness that goes on. And so therefore, when people are telling you about their children right now, especially in these early years, it hurts so much that you have to protect yourself against it. But remember that at some point down the road, you'll be stronger. And it'll always hurt when you hear the mention of a family, but you'll have some distance to it, and you'll be able to say, well, you know, that's good for them. And
I want to add something, because I think we've all experienced that kind of feeling where somebody is talking to you and you're just feeling horrible with what they're saying. I mean, I remember after Kobe was killed, somebody started talking to me complaining because she had to go to her son's graduation. Mm-hmm. And one of the mothers we work with, I remember she said to me that sometimes she just prays for compassion for other people. And I think that's something I do sometimes. When somebody's telling me something that hurts me so much, I just pray, please God, help me. Help me be in this place and bear this, because it's just too hard for me now.
I'd like to tell a story about, you know, when Aaron first died, a friend of his, whom he would have married, they had broken up before he died, but she was still a close friend of mine, and she got married. And I wanted to be there at the wedding, and this was the next year. Well, it was a big mistake going to that wedding, because I nearly died. You know, I had to just leave so as not to upset them. Several years ago, or last year, one of my son's college roommates got married to a girl I introduced him to, and I went to the wedding, and I danced all night. So that, to me, is the change.
Right.
I still missed my son terribly, but I could dance and I could enjoy for them.
But I think I would just want to add also, you have to surround yourself with love.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you receive enough love in the face of this tragedy, then you can also receive people with love. But you can't do that unless you're surrounded by people who can give to you. And that's why it's important to have go to a therapist or a grief counselor and have a place where you can really express the truth. Because the truth, I remember I would say the most terrible things to my friend, like, I wish this person's kid would die so they would know what it felt like. And that's a terrible thing to say. Horrible. And a terrible thing to feel. And I can't believe I'm saying it in public. But once I said it, I was better.
Hi, my name is Arlene Holmes. I lost my only child to homicide in the city 4 months ago. And I need to know, what can you say to me and what can I do to erase this thought that keep on going in my head that as a mother, you are supposed to protect your children or your child. And I always keep on saying that I wish I was there to take one of the bullets that my son took. And it's a struggle for me some days to just, you know, to get out of bed. And it still just play with me that I wish that I could be with my son.
What was your son's name?
My son's name was Kyle. And even though I have two beautiful grandsons, it's nothing like carrying and, you know, having your own child. And I really miss my son. I know I need to go to, like, counseling, but my son's girlfriend and my sister, they've been to therapists and counselors, and they said that they come out worse than what they went in because the counselors are crying more than what they are crying, so they didn't get anything from, like, the counselors. So it's making me a little skeptical about, so how can you choose a good therapist or counselor?
Let me stop you here, and also Dorothy, I think, can really address your question. This is a subject that is really close to my heart because, you know, I thought I was a good counselor before Aaron died, and, you know, after Aaron died, I realized, yeah, I'm a good counselor, but there's something about that kind of grief. We do not have enough trauma-informed counselors. It's as simple as that, and it's a really terrible situation. We need more training.
What are the questions we need to ask when we see a therapist to make sure we're in the right place?
We need to find out what kind of trauma training they have, and we need to know that they're listening to us and that they've been at least around violence enough that they can be able to carry the story, because we know as victims when a counselor can carry our story and when they can't. But Dorothy, you go and answer her question.
Been having that conversation that we do need to have grief therapists that are trained in that area to be able to support families who've experienced a death by murder. It's a different kind of loss and a different kind of grief.
And could you address the issue that she raised about the guilt?
I think as mothers, we always think that no matter the circumstances, there should have been something that we could have done. As mothers, we think our only job here on earth is to protect our children. So when we lose a child, we automatically think that there should have been something we could have done. And we, you know, we are beating ourselves up oftentimes with the woulda, shoulda, couldas, you know, and feeling responsible and having that guilt piece be such a big piece. But it's important to be able, again, to get the proper counseling to work through that. My son was 24 years old. He moved out of the home. But for a long while, I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't have let him move, you know. But he was 24 years old, and that was something that 24-year-old, you know, young men do. I just think it's a parent thing. And we feel that guilt no matter what. But it's important to have the support you need to work through that, because they're feelings and they're real. You can't deny them. They are real feelings that you have, and you have to, you know, get the support you need to be able to work through them.
Let me
just add something. I don't think there is any mother who loves their child who wouldn't take that bullet for that child. So your feelings are right on, and you're going to have to deal with them because they are the real feelings.
I also want to talk about the guilt, because also children in a family also feel the guilt. They also feel that they could have done something to prevent it, and even young children. So it's important to address also with children. And in terms of feeling the grief as a kind of madness, it does feel like that. You feel like you're dying. You're dying, but you're not dead. And you want to die. I wanted to die. I mean, I think we all wanted to die. And how do you deal with that pain? You need a lot of help. You need help.
Well, and you need help dealing with the pain. You need a container. You need to be with people who are able to either love you enough to help you feel safe with your own craziness, or you need to be with a therapist who's got the strength and the courage and the clarity to not try to fix you or overreact to you, who's able to try to fathom something that's unfathomable. I just want to share an observation with the three of you, with the audience. As I listen to you, I recall a radio show we did fairly recently. It was on chronic pain and how physical pain and how over time what heals us is when we finally understand that the pain's not going to go away, and then we find a way to live with it, that we don't have the pain because something's wrong with our body or something's wrong with our doctor or something's wrong with the world. It's our pain now. It's simply our pain, and pain is pain, and we find a way to live with it. What you have done is you have taken your pain. Moreover, you've taken your devotion to your children, your adoration, your devotion as mothers, and you've turned it right around, and you've now devoted to the larger world, to something bigger and bigger and bigger. And our world, this world, desperately needs people who are devoted to healing the larger world. And as an inhabitant of that world, I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
You've been listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion with three mothers who lost their sons to violence. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Funding for this event was made possible in part by the Jewish Family and Children's Service. You can listen to archive editions of Voices in the Family on our website, whyy.org/voices. Thank you to Susan Polinko and Jennifer Wheeler from WHYY's Children's Service. The engineers for today's show have been John Knapp and Al Banks. We had production assistance from Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our host is Dan Gottlieb. I'm Mike and Scott, producer of Voices in the Family. Thank you for listening.
The Carter Theater Center supports WHYY and presents the world premiere of Edward Albee's Me, Myself, and I, January 11th through February 17th. Featuring Tyne Daly and Brian Murray, this dark, humorous, and